I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. A few years back, a young kid from the Bronx made news when he pitched his New York team into the Little League World Series. When it turned out that Danny Almonte was too old to play, that his dad had altered the age on Danny's passport, the nation's indignation reverberated all the way up to the Oval Office. In the end, it was nothing more than just one more desperate play by Danny's immigrant father and his coach to get ahead. They got caught. Ask yourself, would you lie or cheat if it meant a chance to get ahead? A promotion? A shot at that new job? If you figure out a way to skip around the parking authorities or the insurance company or the people who give you cell phone service, do you do that? Is that cheating? Surveys and studies reveal a country of people increasingly willing to scam the system, to lie on applications and resumes, to cheat in financial affairs, and to do it, well, because that's what you do, to get ahead, right? Or wrong? What do you think? How far will you go to get yours? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour has studied the habits of the nation and titled his new book, The Cheating Culture. His name is David Callahan. He's here with me in the studio. David, nice to have you here.
Great to be here.
You make the case in the book that people are cheating more than they used to. Is that a difficult case to make? Is it hard to prove that?
Well, cheating by its nature is meant to go undetected. And there's not a lot of good data out there. There are not a lot of big surveys that ask people what they do when it comes to getting ahead and the corners they cut. But I think there is more cheating today. I think that the 80s and 90s have been one of these periods where we have all been obsessed with getting ahead. We've been judging our self-worth by our net worth and been very focused on money and status. It's, you know, we've been through these periods before. Cheating is not a new phenomenon. It's not a new thing. But the 80s and 90s and still the era we live in now, I think, has been one of these times.
Do you sort of put it up to the system that I have my own little personal list of things that are in the system? I get to scan the system. You have your own little personal list. I mean, maybe you'll, avoid the parking authorities if you can, and I feel guilty about it, and I put money in the meter. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is that how you sort of get at the heart of it, that people will be willing to lie and cheat only in certain areas?
Well, I think different people cheat for different reasons. I think that people at the top, what I call the winning class, I think they're cheating because they think that they can get away with it. And all too often that is true. Government watchdogs have been flat on their back. And the people at the top are also cheating because the rewards are so huge, that CEOs get paid more than ever, sluggers in baseball get paid more than ever. The carrots have gotten bigger and juicier. And ordinary people, meanwhile, I think many of them are cheating because they're cynical. They think the rules are stacked against them. They feel a lot of financial pressures in their daily life. And they're wondering, you know, why should I be a chump and play by all the rules when...
Okay, now you're going to have to help me with the numbers here because I'm not good at keeping them in my head. But the Wall Street hotshots, Blodgett, you use as an example of somebody who makes a whole pile of money and then ends up with a fine that doesn't really chew into that much, right?
Henry Blodgett made $12 million in 2001, and when he was finally called to task for misrepresenting the value of tech stocks, he ended up paying a fine of $4 million that was imposed by Elliot Spitzer in a settlement where Blodgett admitted no wrongdoing.
And that's what the rest of us look at and go, well, why not get ours? Is that part of what's behind a change in attitude in America?
Well, tax evasion is the classic example of, you know, the number one complaint that Americans have about taxes is not that they pay too much, and it's not that taxes are too complex. It is that the rich don't pay their fair share. And when it comes time to file taxes, you know, many people think, why should I be paying every last cent of my taxes when I know well that, you know, the rich are taking advantage of these tax shelters and these loopholes? And people are very cynical.
Let's bring Joe Kolitar into the conversation. He's a principal with Ernst & Young and a specialist with their Global Investigations and Dispute Advisory Services. Joe, it's good to have you with us on the program.
Dick, good to be with you.
You've been listening to David's description of people's attitudes here. Is it your belief that there's more, what's it called, occupational fraud today than there used to be?
I don't know if there's more, but we are certainly finding a lot more. The size of it is absolutely staggering.
Give me an example.
The entire fast food industry in this country, all the hamburger, pizza, chicken places, is about $100 billion a year. Occupational fraud, which is fraud committed by employees against their employing organization, is six times bigger. It's $600
billion. $600 billion?
Six times bigger than fast food.
You're not talking about people taking pens home from the office here.
No, these are willful frauds. This is not copying your kid's soccer schedule on the office machine.
David, is this part of what you're talking about? $600 billion is a pretty frightening figure.
Well, yeah, it's 6% of GDP. And, you know, there are in this area, there are no good surveys which ask employees why they're ripping off their employer. But, you know, if you look at how people feel about work these days, people feel that their employers are not as loyal to them as they are to their employer. People feel that their employers do not treat them fairly. People feel a lot of anxiety and anger about their health benefits being pared back or their salaries being stagnant. And I think that this has something to do with it because, remember, this stuff has been epidemic. Employee theft is epidemic at a time when shoplifting and other crimes, regular crime, has been going down.
Joe Kolitar, when you get a chance to sort of pin somebody down for occupational fraud and you ask them why, what are they telling you these days?
Very often they're still in a state of denial or they don't want to talk because even though you have the goods on them, they're still trying to negotiate a deal or they're hoping for the best. But the best theory that we have on it, and the ones that do talk sort of confirm this theory, actually goes back to the 1930s. It was developed by a man by the name of Cressy, who was a researcher. And he called it the Iron Triangle of fraud. And it's the means, the opportunity, and most important from the discussion we're having now, the perceived need, that I have a need or I have a right to do this.
And could the perceived need be that my neighbor just got a plasma screen TV and I'd really like to find $10,000 quick?
Sure. I work harder than he does. He has a better job than I do. He plays golf half of the time. But, you know, here I am with a small TV and there he is with a big one. It's not right.
Is there more opportunity for people to do this now, Joe?
Unfortunately, there is for a number of reasons. Globalization, you're no longer doing business with a company down the block. You're doing business with a company 1,000 miles away or two continents away. Computers are anonymous. They're fast. They're a good tool to detect fraud, but they're, unfortunately, they're also a good tool to commit fraud. And with corporate downsizing, it has really hit the ranks of middle management. You just don't tend to have as much middle management supervision as you did.
David, is it your experience that people still don't necessarily want to shortchange the greengrocer on the corner, but because we're in this kind of global world that Joe's talking about, that it's easier to commit the fraud because we don't see whoever it is we're committing it against?
Well, it's easier to rip off somebody that you don't know personally. But in the case of this employee theft and fraud, people are ripping off employers that they know personally often. And that's an interesting thing, that they are willing to rip off employers that they see every day.
Did you come up with an explanation as to why people would be willing to do that, or perhaps even more willing to do it today than they would have 10, 20 years ago?
Well, I place it in the context of the changing conditions at work, that there's a lot less job security. People feel that there's a lot less loyalty by their employers. That there's just a sense that work is not the secure and happy place that it used to be. Pervasive anxiety out there these days. And I actually have a question for Joe. You know, you say that you're not sure there's more of it today, but some of the research I looked at by KPMG suggested that there was, in fact, an increase of employee theft in some areas during the 1990s, that there was an increase in the misuse of expense account, for example.
David, please don't misunderstand me. I agree with you totally. I just am allowing for the fact that we're more attuned to it now, and we're probably finding more of it because a lot of it tends to stay hidden. That's one of the problems you have in looking at this field, is that many organizations don't want to air their dirty laundry. They don't want to report to the police. They'll let the employee resign for personal reasons instead of terminating them. So getting good data on this is very, very difficult.
Joe, just a quick last question for you. The people we're talking about, are these lower class, middle class, upper class? Are they young people, old people? Is there anything there that's marking this class we're talking about?
David, I spent 25 years with the FBI before I got into this business in the private sector, so I know a little bit about criminals. Your average street crime is committed by a male they start in their early teens. It peaks at about age 25, and their activity diminishes from that point on. Occupational fraud peaks between 45 and 55.
These are the grown-ups in our society. These are our neighbors.
And 63% of them, according to statistics from the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, are college graduates. And 93% of them have no criminal record.
Joe, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
My pleasure.
Joe Kolitar is a principal with Ernst & Young, Global Investigations and Dispute Advisory Services. We're going to take our first call from Watertown, Massachusetts. Michael's on the line. Michael, what do you think about this?
Well, we've had 20 years of worship of wealthy entrepreneurs and an attempt to enshrine social Darwinism as our national ideal, and this furthers the tendency of the rich who always believe that they basically should be able to do whatever they want, and the poor always do what they must. And so not cheating has been a middle-class virtue, and the middle class is much more precarious than it was. It used to be that you could have a decent life from a middle-class point of view and not go to college, but now it seems to be required, so you have people cheating on college applications.
David?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I talk about this phenomenon of cheating in the context of both economic and cultural shifts over the past 25 years. More people are under more pressure at work, having to work harder to meet their quota, to keep their head above water, lots of financial pressures. At the same time, I think the culture has changed, that social Darwinism has become a stronger force in our society. At the same time that the individualism of the 60s really teamed up with the materialism of the 80s to create a really self-centered and cutthroat culture that we live in today.
Michael, do you agree that it's as cultural as it is economic?
Yes. I think religion in some ways offered a false method of controlling behavior, but very little has come into it.
Why a false method? I mean, I know a lot of people who learned their morals in Bible class, you know?
Because it controlled people by making them afraid of hell, of a vengeful God that a lot of people eventually, especially as they got more money, found it harder to believe in. But instead, now we have essentially every man for himself and God against all. So why should anyone care about another man or woman or about God?
Just to add to that, the values debate that we've had in this country over the past 20 years has been largely orchestrated by conservatives, and they have been focused on a particular set of values concerns, breakdown of the family, crime, drugs, sexuality, abortion, homosexuality, prayer in schools. All of those values concerns have gotten a great deal of attention in national debates over the past quarter century. But a different set of value concerns really hasn't been part of this debate, which is, envy, greed, lack of compassion for the less fortunate, the problems that come with inequality. Those have not been on the agenda.
We're talking about cheating this hour. We're talking about some of the cultural roots, the economic roots, even some of the political roots that my guest David Callahan just mentioned. Connection listeners, do you cheat? Would you cheat? What are your own standards? What are your own personal scales of justice? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. If you're driving in your car, if there's three lanes of traffic and the left lane is a left turn lane and there's a great big line there, what will you do? Will you get in the line? Will you sneak up beside it and try and dodge in front? Is that cheating or is that fair? Is that just the way to beat the system? We'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. In this hour, we're talking with David Callahan about his new book, The Cheating Culture, Why More Americans Are Doing Wrong to Get Ahead. And David, at one point in the book, you take us to a very young age and say that you can actually mark this among students in the early grades of high school.
Well, 75% of high school students admitted cheating in a 2002 survey, up from 61% just a decade ago.
75% admitted to cheating.
Yeah, within the past year in 2002, up from 61% in 1992. And, you know, in my book, I contrast two schools. I look at Horace Mann, which is one of the most elite private schools in New York City, and also at Stuyvesant High School, which is a big public school. And the students at Horace Mann were cheating often because they don't want to mess things up. You know, they come from the winning class. Their parents are very successful. They're all assuming they're going to Harvard and Princeton, and they want to make sure that that happens. And they don't want to do anything that will compromise their A average, and they're willing to cut corners to ensure that they get into Harvard. Whereas the students from Stuyvesant High School, often coming from immigrant families, feel that this is their only shot, that they're clawing their way up, and Stuyvesant High School gives them this opportunity to launch themselves into the Ivy League, and you know, their parents are pushing them, and they don't want to mess up, you know. So it's
two different schools, same result, everybody's
right.
Cheating.
But it's the anxious class at Stuyvesant High School and the winning class at Horace Mann, different rationales but same behavior.
One of the people you quote in your book is Tom Parker, who's dean of admissions at Amherst College, and Tom's joining us on the line for a couple of minutes. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Dick.
You see these applications from these high school students. Now, you've been in this business for what, close to 20 years now?
Over 20 years.
Have you seen a change? Have you seen people more willing to lie or cheat or pad the application to try and get into, for example, to get into Amherst?
Certainly. And again, it depends on your definition of cheating. I don't know if you would call it outright an increase in outright fraud or outright cheating in the application process, but you certainly see precious few people who are interested in a level playing field at this point, and more people who are willing to pay for any service, whatever, that would give them an edge in the process. And certainly this again is against the background of greater and greater desperation to get into this particularly small set of prestigious colleges and universities.
Now, David tells me that there are now consultants that you can hire for your high school student who will not only, you know, tell you at a very young age which volunteer organizations you ought to join, but how to put together your college application and even help you with the essay that is supposed to be the personal essay. When that application lands on your desk, Tom, can you see that? Can you see the sort of social design and desperation in the applications today?
Sure. I should say that there is enough. I read an application as if I'm an attorney in a certain sense, and I'm presented with evidence. And there's a great deal of evidence in any file. And in most cases, it's internally extraordinarily consistent. But every once in a while, it's not. And where we have to work very hard is determining if a student has a modest verbal SAT and a spectacular essay, whether that's a person who genuinely doesn't test well and is very bright, or whether that's a person who's paid for an essay, and we come to differing conclusions. There are some cases where you say, yeah, this is probably not the student's work. But I will say that in 90% of the cases, the files are extraordinarily consistent. But there's, again, yes, the sheer number of guides to getting into college, the sheer number of consultants throughout this country is really staggering to look at, and the sheer amount of money that is being made by capitalizing on the anxiety of families going through the process is staggering as well.
Do you think it's a pretty stupid thing? Do you think it makes sense?
This is a fascinating thing. In some cases, students end up shooting themselves in the foot, because if you are advised every which way to Sunday, which some students are, you end up producing extraordinarily bland, generic work. And there is a kind of shooting oneself in the foot in so doing. What I see is it's really quite irrational. And behind all of it is this idea. You've talked a good bit about, you know, a kind of free-floating anxiety engendered by globalization, instability in the workplace, all of that. But somehow folks have fastened on to getting into Harvard or Yale or Amherst or some such place as being a constant, and somehow that's going to ensure a life free of anxiety, when in fact I think anyone who's lived a life knows that, sure, Harvard's going to give you a leg up at the beginning, but life is long, and there are plenty of people who succeed by who don't go to Harvard, and plenty of people who go to Harvard and live lives that are, you know, less successful than you might expect. But there's a very peculiar attaching of all of this anxiety. I think probably in an irrational, maybe even neurotic manner on getting into these places, or conversely not getting into these places and therefore being at a terrible disadvantage for the rest of one's life.
All right, Tom, I want to thank you for being with us.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Tom Barker, Dean of Admissions at Amherst College.
Well, as insecurity in this economy has grown, people are looking for whatever protection they can get. And people see name brand degrees as being their best chance of being able to get the good jobs and keep the good jobs in this economy. We have even, you know, now we have more of these knowledge jobs being exported overseas. So this anxiety is only going to grow. But, and it's not irrational. The name brand universities have recruiters from the best corporations that come and look for employees, whereas a lot of other non-name brand schools do not get that kind of recruiting attention. So it does make sense to go to those top schools. And both the kids and the parents are in it together. You know, in my book, we talked to some of the private tutors who
right.
work with kids at elite schools. And these private tutors are accountable to no one except the parents who write the checks. And they will write papers for kids. They will do the kids' homework. They will, you know, do anything that the kids ask them to do, or they will be replaced by tutors who will take those orders.
And as David points out, if you don't actually get into Harvard, it doesn't matter. You can just say that you went and graduated from Harvard on your resume, with the increase in people lying about degrees that they have. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. All right, connection listeners, do you cheat? Will you cheat? How do you look at this? David's on the line now from Boston. David, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. I was driving to work this morning. I heard your little intro about what would you do if you got like free cable or free money out of the ATM, and I actually had free cable coming into my home, and I called the company and I told them to bill me for it.
And why did you do that?
It was very easy. I didn't want it for free. If I wanted it for free, you know, I would have, you know, went out and bought something. But I happen to have a TV that has a built-in cable receiver, and I had hooked it up and it got cable, and I said I want to be billed for it, what it costs, and I'm not a thief, and I didn't want to be construed as having purposely set it up so I was stealing it. It's about integrity, and if I had a problem with the system, I could call them, and I could deserve service. But if I'm not being billed for it, I have no right to get service for it.
Now, David Callahan, in kind of a head-shaking way in his book, says people who do that kind of honest thing end up as chumps in society. What's your way of looking at that,
David?
Oh,
I'm glad you bring that up, because that's the last thing I want to view myself as a chump. In fact, I see some integrity issues going on in the workplace right now, and I'm doing everything possible to make sure that I'm not a chump about it, but I'm going through normal channels. And,
give me an example, of, as best you can, of what you're talking about.
I don't
about.
Want it because I want to be anonymous.
All right.
But it just you have to stand up for yourself, both in an integrity way. If something comes to you that you don't deserve, you have to be have integrity about it. But you have to have integrity about people that are not calling the company and are stealing from the company. That's just, otherwise they're basically stealing from you, because those costs are passed on to all of us. And we have to be true to ourselves and make other people be true to themselves, because we're all in it together.
It's great to have your call, because I end my book by saying that, you know, while a lot of this cheating in our society is driven by structural causes, more insecurity and such, you know, we all have a very personal role to play in turning this around. If you don't cheat and if I don't cheat, that's two fewer people who are part of everybody. And if a few of our friends don't cheat, pretty soon maybe it's just some people who are cheating. And this vicious cycle of everybody cheating and then everybody else thinking it's okay to cheat can be turned around. And we can have a virtuous cycle.
David in Boston, when you look for role models in society, or a way of saying, hey, I'm like so-and-so. I mean, do you see this kind of I've had enough of the cheating role model anywhere in politics, anywhere in business, anywhere in the community?
No, I don't. I don't look for role models like that. I mean, you have to have yourself be your role model. And I'm not saying I'm like perfect, because I'm not. And I know I'm not.
No, that's fine. I mean,
but
the reason,
like,
I ask about the role...
You just have to strive to be your best.
Yeah.
And that's all you can ask of yourself. And you have to be able to be happy with yourself. And if some of the people that are cheat are happy with that, then that's them, you know? That's them. But it will haunt them. It will come back to get them in the long run. There's only so long you can keep cheating. It will get you.
David, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Nice to have you on the program. And David Callahan here. The reason I brought up role models is because it's something you note in your book that we seem to be somewhat lacking these days. It's harder to take a sort of position that our caller just takes than the sort of everybody's doing it, I got to get mine. What was the cover on Newsweek that you referenced in the book? Why is everybody else getting rich, or something like that?
That was at the height of the boom. There was a cover that said, everybody's getting rich except me. But this notion of role models, this is a very important part of my story here. You know, I think that the rich, the powerful, the strong in our society are very admired. They have always been in American history. But more so than ever in the 80s and 90s, we've worshipped CEOs, we've worshipped celebrities, we worshipped sports figures. When these people behave badly, I think it really sends a signal to others who follow their influences. And lately, a lot of these people have been behaving badly.
But let's be fair about that. I mean, at any one given time, there might be two or three basketball players whose names are in the news because they're before the courts for infidelity or drugs or whatever. That leaves hundreds of thousands of basketball players whose names are not in the news. So, I mean, the role models ends up being the ones in the news who are the ones who break the law. And I'm wondering whether or not we're seeing a clear view here.
Well, it's unfortunate that a lot of the bad guys end up getting so much attention. But it just really has an impact. I mean, especially with the CEOs. I mean, sports figures we kind of expect to be sort of bad guys often. I mean, they're engaged in very rough and tumble competition on the court. But CEOs, they're supposed to be sort of these models of responsibility. They're leading major corporations. They're making tons of money. They don't really have any good excuse for behaving badly. It shouldn't be part of their lives. And I think that these corporate scandals and all the white collar crime just sends a terrible, terrible signal.
1-800-423-8255. That's our number. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Mike's joining us now. Mike, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could comment on the pervasive attitude of finders keepers, where we had a situation in North Carolina where some state employees were, by a clerical error, overpaid about 15 cents a day for about a year and a half. And when it was discovered, they didn't want to give it back because they said that they were underpaid anyway. And they based the rest of their argument on that a clerical error had been made for teachers also, and they didn't have to give it back, so they didn't have to give it back either, was their attitude.
I'm not fast enough to do the math, Mike, but we're not talking about a lot of money. What was your opinion? Do you think those government employees should have given it back?
Well, obviously, I thought they should have, and I discussed it with their organizational leader, and I said, so for 15 cents a day, you are compromising, you know, your ethics. And he says, well, they made a mistake, and so we should be able to keep it. And I just couldn't believe that he would make a statement like that, and it was in the press, in the paper. And there was a universal acceptance of that attitude.
Bank error in your favor. Collect $200.
Right. Well, I'm fascinated by the ways in which people rationalize cheating in ordinary life. You listen to the people who engage in music piracy, their rationalizations usually focus on how bad the record companies are, and the record companies are ripping them off with their $18 CDs, so why not download music? Or the people who lie about their auto insurance claims, they say, you know, the auto insurance company is ripping me off every month with my premium. I'm just getting back what I deserve.
But Mike's point here is that the people, the employees themselves, didn't actually say, hey, I know how to scam for 15 cents a day. they didn't actively do anything to cheat. They just wound up with, you know, 50, 60 bucks extra in their pay pack, and they're saying, hey, tough luck.
Right.
You guys screwed up.
But a lot of the cheating that people engage in happens kind of passively. Like at tax time, there's a lot of accountants who say, hey, you know, you sure you don't want to add some deductions? The IRS doesn't really audit it people anymore. And a lot of taxpayers go along. It's pretty astounding the complicity of accountants or the active role that accountants are playing.
So
in
if
tax
a tax accountant says to you, David, hey, we can write off so much of your car payments or your car insurance or the rent that you're paying on your flat because you're a writer and you work at home and you kind of work in your car, what do you say?
I say no. I mean, I happen to believe pretty deeply in government and the role of government in this society and think that it's important to pay taxes. But a lot of people do go along, and a lot of that has to do with the cynicism of not just about government but about the lack of taxes that wealthy people are paying in this society.
It's hard to fault the people who feel so aggrieved, though. I mean, that's the interesting part of this puzzle. It's not good guys and bad guys. There's a lot of people in the middle who are going, what do I do?
Right. Yes. Well, you see that in cable television theft, that a lot of the people who are ripping off the cable company feel that these are just terrible companies. And so if you suddenly discover you're getting free premium cable stations, you know, a lot of people don't go out of their way to tell the cable company about it and are happy just to be getting back after so many years of feeling exploited.
All right, Connection listeners, we'd like to hear from you on this subject. Are there places where you'll cheat and places where you won't cheat? Is it kind of an imbalance in the justice system that you see, and so you sort of have to create your own sense of justice? And if so, what's that? Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. David Callahan is with me in the studio. His new book's called The Cheating Culture, Why More Americans Are Doing Wrong to Get Ahead. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
You're cheating hard. Will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. David Callahan is Director of Research at New York's Public Policy Center, DEMOS, founder as well of that, and author of a new book called The Cheating Culture. That's what we're talking about this hour on The Connection. Will you cheat? Why do you cheat? Why do people cheat? 1-800-423-TALK. Back to the lines to Boston, and Chris is joining us. Chris, thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a story where I cheated and got caught, but it's turned out to be something that has changed my life for the better.
What happened?
Well, more than cheating, I was lying. On my resume, I used to put that I had graduated college, not Harvard, but University of Massachusetts at Boston, where I had been going, but had stopped my studying after I got a job. And just as the roaring 90s were going, it never felt necessary to finish up the degree, and I wasn't interested in computer science to the degree that I wanted to put my nights into it.
Right.
So I left. I just changed my resume and felt that I had done the work necessary, so I didn't have to go to school. And recently, I got laid off, and pretty soon after that, got a job offer, and they called and checked UMass Boston, and I lost the job. And it was pretty harsh because it was such a tough economic time, and especially for computer science. But it changed me. I went back to school and had been looking into GIS for 2 years, kind of thinking about it. GIS is Geographic Information Services.
Yeah.
And I am now on my way to graduating this June, summa cum laude, and I will have a new career.
Now, did your attitude about lying or cheating change simply because you were caught? I mean, was that the transforming moment for you, Chris?
It was, because I had a wife who had been adamant about me not doing that. She is the most straight and narrow of all people I've ever met, and very, you know, respect her a lot for that. A
little bit of "I told you so" on the dinner at the dinner table then.
Yeah. And so I got to rethink it, and I was like, I don't want to have to lie anymore, because it was something I, you know, friends that were bosses I had kept it from.
Chris, stay with me for a minute, because I want to bring David in here. David, you make the point in your book that more and more people are feeling compelled to lie in order to get ahead, or in order to make their way, crawl ahead of the neighbor, right?
Well, it's become more rational, I think.
What do you mean more rational? More accepted, or more less like lying and cheating?
Well, it feels more rational to cheat if you feel like you're going to lose your job if you don't cheat. It feels more rational if the rewards are bigger for cheating. It feels more rational if you have less of a chance of getting caught. And all of the, you know, we've seen changes in all those regards in society in the last 25 years. The rewards are bigger, the pressures are greater, and a lot of the watchdogs have been asleep.
Does this match up with you, Chris, that it was either a job that you thought you wouldn't get if you didn't say you'd graduated or even be considered for?
Yeah, I felt like the system took it that they wanted the degree, even though I had the experience and could do and had proven I could do the job. So that's why I put it on there. And after taking it off, I didn't get many callbacks. And that's when I was like, you know what? I have to change my life. And but it's worked out for the best for me.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Good luck. 1-800-423-8255. Next to, where are we going? To Lafayette, Louisiana. Richard is joining us now. Richard, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Thank you, sir. Thank you first for allowing me to introduce my observations.
And
I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, go ahead. What is your observation?
I deal with kids regularly. I mean, I love kids. I have a fascination for making sure that a child will go on the right path. My greatest dilemma that I have, my inside of myself, is how do we take out of a society that we have bred to cheat? We have made it acceptable to cheat. To get ahead, to get things. They see mom and dad. They see auntie and uncle. They see the presidency under scandal. They see Martha Stewart. We can talk on and on about what they see. But we have bred this into our children, and our children are our future. And if we have to rely on our kids to be our future, then we're giving a whole nother society something that we should have never introduced in the first place, cheating. A long time ago, had I done something like that, I'm only 32 years old, and I'll say prior to that, had something like that gone on around my parents or my grandfather or my grandmother, then, I mean, there would be great, great amounts of trouble. And that's dwindled away to dad having to do it to get ahead and mom having to do it to get ahead. And
Richard, I want to interrupt you because I want you to help me with a slightly more close look at this. What was happening with you and your dad, which is different from kids today? Why is it that you're saying our fathers were a lot less inclined to cheat than the fathers of kids we're talking about today?
Well, I speak from, I look at the business, I look at the way things are in life. I look at the way what automobiles cost now as opposed to what they were then, what college tuition costs now as opposed to what it was then, what just a medical visit costs now as opposed to what it was then, and the job situations in life being what they are now, and that's a reality that things are just harder now than they were. And I take that back. Things are harder back then than they were now. There was less opportunity for people that I know of to get out there and cheat. I mean, cheating led to just what the last caller spoke of, getting fired on the job and things like that. And those people didn't have the time to really think about losing their job. They had a family that they had to take care of, and they had to take care of that family by any means necessary. I mean, cheating now, you can lie on an application and say you have a college degree, and, I mean, that's, what, $30,000, $40,000 more than someone who's out there driving a truck?
Yeah. Now, Richard, I want to take the point that you're making and ask David to talk a little bit about this, because I think he's got something when he says it was harder for people, you know, to save enough money to buy a car based on your average working wage 20 or 30 years ago. So why wouldn't it have been the reverse? Why wouldn't the people have been more interested in cheating back then to get that money, David?
Well, actually, I don't think that that's true, that the wages for people, say, with only a high school diploma have gone down pretty substantially in the last 25 years. I mean, if you look at economic trends, the middle class has just barely been running in place. The working class has been losing ground, and most of the economic income gains have gone to the top 20%. So it used to be that people could achieve the American dream with a high school diploma, and those who had a college degree were very well set up indeed. Now we have all these middle class families and a lot of upper middle class families who are finding that it's very difficult to make it even on a six-figure income. You know, more people file for bankruptcy every year than file for divorce. There's a lot of pressure out there on people who should be doing well.
So it sort of comes back to where we began the program with our first caller, who was saying that there is no middle to the middle class. There is no it's not as easy as it used to be to say, I'm not going to take the job that you know, makes me rich in 10 years. I'm going to take the job that gives me job satisfaction, even if it doesn't pay that well, because I want a good life.
And not only are a lot of middle class and upper middle class families under intense economic pressure, but the pressures around affluence have grown so much. I mean, that the images of the good life that we see on television and in magazines are so persistent. I mean, a six-figure income is portrayed as the norm on television shows and in magazines at a time when the average household income is $42,000 a year in this country.
Let's go to Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam's on the line. Sam, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I'm thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that another way to maybe to understand what we're talking about is that there's more than one system of rules. I remember when I was a kid, I forget the name of the story, it's probably some Russian story about the poor person who steals something to feed his family. Well, there's one set of rules that says you don't steal. There's another set of rules that says your primary responsibility is to feed your family. So I think when you look at it that way, I think in our culture especially, there are systems of rules embedded within systems of rules. And in particular, what I'm looking at is there's a rule that says it's okay to break the rule if you can get away with it. And I think that I'm just guessing that as people are getting a little bit better informed, one of the big things that I see, and I think it's what Mr. Edwards is running his campaign on, is that they're two Americas, and they definitely have different sets of rules. So I think maybe the whole phenomenon is a little more complicated.
Stay with me, Sam, because one of the things that David writes about is two moral compasses, and I think that's in part what Sam's talking about, isn't it, David?
Right. Well, I come back to the again and again looking at people who face a trade-off in their life between holding on to their integrity or holding on to their financial security. And when you put people in that kind of dilemma, they'll almost always choose their financial security. I have a story in my book about auto mechanics at Sears who Sears instituted a new commission-based pay system, which gave a lot of new insecurity to these mechanics. And they started making up a lot of repairs that didn't actually need to be done on cars. And Sears had a huge scandal around its auto repair centers because it instituted this new kind of pay system that created insecurity for its workers there. And I think that there's a lot of changes that have occurred like that in sector after sector of the economy where people are under more pressure and also have the option to cut corners, and people often will take that option.
Do you think that systems, David also, Sam writes about rank and yank in the economic system where companies like Enron and GE would rank their workforce and fire the bottom 10% as a way of sort of pushing and driving. Is that a little bit of what leads people to feel like they have to cheat? Sam, are you there?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, I was.
Well. I don't know. I mean, I think that, I think there are all different reasons why people don't play. I prefer to call it not playing by the rules,
or
you can say it's cheating. But I think a big one that I see is that if you're embedded in a system where a certain class of people are not playing by the rules but have the power to enforce the rules and make you play by them. It sets up a very peculiar dynamic, and I think that's what we see in the justice system over and over and over again, where on the one hand we're saying that in this country everyone's got a fair shot, everyone's got their day in court, but the reality is that's not the way it works at all. That if you don't have the wherewithal to play the game, you're going to be playing by a different set of rules.
Yeah, particularly, you can end up in club Fed instead.
I come back to the theme of unequal justice in this country quite a bit. You know, we actually live in a law and order period where we have been extremely harsh with a certain set of wrongdoers. We have 2 million people in our prisons, more than ever before. We live in an era of three strikes and you're out, of zero tolerance in schools, of harsh welfare reform. You know, this has been a really tough era, and yet cheating is up, and we coddle many cheaters at the top or in the professional classes.
So what's the fix, though, Dave?
And there's a real contradiction there. Well, at the broadest level, I think that there's a need for a new social contract. You know, people need to feel, in order to follow the rules and to want to follow the rules, people need to feel that they live in a society where if you play by the rules, you have a great chance of getting ahead and living a decent life. And you also get some say in how the rules are made, and you have a voice in that through democracy. And if you break the rules, you're treated the same as everyone else. And, you know, that's not the society we live in right now. There are a lot of people who are playing by the rules, who've done everything right, and who feel that they don't have a decent life, they don't have health care insurance, they don't have affordable housing.
But where does it start, though? Does it start with some new character in politics? Does it start with some CEO making some unusual statement?
I think it comes down to we need better values and we need tougher watchdogs as sort of the most basic starting point.
I mean, keep people honest, then.
Well, the people at the top who set such an example for the rest of our society cannot be allowed to get away with the kinds of things they've been getting away with. The Securities and Exchange Commission that polices Wall Street, the IRS, these agencies have been starved of resources, and we have an immense amount of wrongdoing by people who know that they won't be caught. Or if they do get caught, they'll be able to get out of it with high-priced legal teams. And if they can't get out of it, maybe they'll spend, you know, a year or two at some country club prison. And the rest of America, ordinary people, they see that. And I think it engenders cynicism. And so we need to deal with that problem. And it shouldn't be that hard in terms of strengthening watchdogs.
David, thanks so much for coming in.
Great to be here.
David Callahan, author of The Cheating Culture, Why More Americans Are Doing Wrong to Get Ahead. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
I don't know what can be done about it. If you play the game, you get nothing out of it. Find out for yourself. Drive in a goody goody. You better cheat, cheat. No reason to play fair. Cheat, cheat, or don't get anywhere. Cheat, cheat, and you can't win. Wanna survive, you better learn how to lie.